This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
If you've ever needed hope that dark times don't last forever, look no further than Jazz Thornton. Jazz's story is one of incredible hope. She's a filmmaker, a podcaster, and co-founder of a suicide prevention organisation, Voices of Hope. And she's also the survivor of 14 suicide attempts between the tender ages of 12 and 20. The journey from then to now is one that she's shared in films, in the media, in a TED talk, and she's with me to share it now. Jazz, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Jazz, your journey through this goes right back to childhood, as many of these stories do. You're a Kiwi from New Zealand, so tell me a little bit about your growing up years first.
So I grew up in a very small town in the South Island of New Zealand called Timaru. And I don't remember a lot of my childhood. I was kind of, you know, your kind of classic toddler that loved Barney and like all of that kind of thing. But then when I was three, kind of everything started to change. And I read my child protection files recently that kind of talk about from that age about me going from happy and bubbly to dull and lacking emotion, and then I started to have massive reactions to the smallest things as a three-year-old. So I had a somewhat kind of normal, very, very early childhood, and then when I was three, kind of everything started to change.
And I know that your first suicide attempt was at the age of 12. What was it that changed in your life? What makes a 12-year-old so depressed that they would want to take their life?
I mean, there was stuff going on at home, but and then there was a whole lot of stuff going on at school as well. So I was being bullied at school. But I think that the biggest thing was just that I had beliefs in me that I was unlovable, that I was a burden, and that I didn't deserve to be here. And I just thought that life would be easier if I wasn't here. And so I don't know if as a 12-year-old I knew that if I did this that I would never wake up again, but to be honest, I really don't think that I cared. You know, I just wanted the pain to end.
And I read that you were also suffered from abuse. Was that a large part of your self-worth problems?
It definitely was a large part of it. You know, my files say that from about at the age of three, I was sexually abused by three different men. And so, you know, that definitely has a lot to play. But when I look back at my story and kind of everything that happened, that sent me on a cycle, a downward spiral. But a lot of it was to do with, you know, within school and kids saying, I remember one time I was about seven and I was out on the playground, went across the monkey bars and I just heard a lot of kids laughing. And I turned around, I didn't know what was going on. And one of the kids piped up and she was just like, oh, no one's going to touch those now because no one wants to catch your disease. And it's things like that is a moment that instilled beliefs that I don't belong here. So I think it was a mixture of both.
Wow. And then after the age of 12, you had a further 13 attempts at suicide and you battled severe mental illness. You spent time in a psychiatric ward. Yeah. But to look at today, you're very much a healthy, recovered person and you're busy and flourishing in life. So what was it that made you start to turn the corner?
There was a few different things that that happened in my life that kind of made that change. I think that the biggest one, and it's a story that I shared in my TED talk, and it's kind of the reason why I do everything that I do, but it was after my final suicide attempt, and I was in the psych ward at the time, and this woman came in, her name's Esther, and she basically was sitting with me and I was bawling my eyes out, and she was like, Jazz, why are you crying? And I turned to her and I was like, I'm just so tired of fighting. And she looked at me and goes, Jazz, what do you think the definition of fighting is? Because I don't think that you're fighting. I think you're only surviving. And it's only when you learn how to fight that the change that you're longing to see is going to happen. And so I remember taking that and going, shoot, like if I've actually just been surviving this whole time and fighting might change something, then I've got to learn how to do that. And so that's kind of the moment that I can pinpoint that everything started to change.
Yeah, wow. So what are some of those practical strategies then that you learnt to use in your recovery?
So what I very quickly discovered was that I wasn't fighting my suicidal tendencies or my suicidal behaviours. I was fighting the beliefs that put me there. So the beliefs, I'm unlovable, I'm a burden, I don't deserve to be here. And so what I did is that I wrote those beliefs down on a piece of paper. I drew a line and then on the other side I wrote down every single thing that people said or did that contradicted those beliefs, so that every time my mind would be, Jazz, you're unlovable, Jazz, you're a burden, I would would pull out this list and I would have solid evidence in front of me that my internal reality wasn't matching the external truth. And then I just, you know, things like engaging in therapy, it's really hard when you're going in with the perception that this is your identity, therefore it will never change. And so learning how to separate myself from it so that when I went in to see a therapist, I went in with the intention of, okay, if this is just something I'm struggling with, then maybe I can work through it. And maybe the psychologist hasn't studied for, you know, 5-6 years and don't know what they're talking about. So kind of all things like that, that really helped me learn how to fight.
Your Christian faith as well is a big part of your life. What role did your faith and prayer and Christian practices actually play in your recovery as well?
It's a story that a lot of people don't actually know. And, you know, we've kind of been strategic in regards to the kind of the secular world because we want people to be able to trust me, trust my story. And my main goal is hope. But for me, after I had that conversation with Esther and I learned how to fight, I remember walking back into church because I had left for a couple of years. I'd done Bible college and everything before that, but I was just so broken and isolated myself. And I remember January 8th, it was, you know, years ago, I walked back into the church and there was this guy by the name of Pastor Lucas Connell preaching. And he has an incredible story of he was in a drug-induced psychosis and like the TV was talking to him and he was sharing this and he was saying that one night in a moment he was lying on his floor in his bedroom and crying out to God and he immediately got set free. And I was listening to this and I was like, this is incredible. Like, what the heck? And so I remember sitting there and going, I can't live like this anymore. It's been 9 years of suicide attempt after suicide attempt after suicide attempt. I can't do this anymore. And I actually just have to give you everything, which is scary because people who are suicidal, freedom is one of the most scariest things, because that means losing control. That means losing relationships that are built upon crisis, all of that. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to give it all over. And Pastor Lucas did an altar call and there was probably like 150 people that responded. And I was down there, literally front and center. And he was kind of praying over everyone in general and then came over to me and started praying and prophesying. And in that single moment, 9 years of suicidal tendencies gone. Wow. Nothing since. But what I learned was that God was able to do that because I learned what it was to live free. So then when he set me free, I didn't run back into my cage. But yeah, so it's been a massive part of my journey as well as the community and my church. I love my church and you know, my mentors and everyone's kind of come from there. So it's a massive part for me in my recovery.
Awesome. Now, I know that your name went a little bit viral last year when you did a Facebook post about thanking Constable Campbell, the policewoman that saved your life a few years ago when you last your final suicide attempt. What was it about her that impacted you so much?
I genuinely think it was the fact that she cared so much. I remember, you know, being in the back of the police car after everything had happened and I was just bawling my eyes out and she had her arms around me. And it was probably about 10 minutes later, I looked up and I just saw her crying. And in my mind, I was like, I don't get it. I don't understand why this stranger, someone who I've never met before, is crying because I just tried to take my life. That doesn't make sense to me. And you know, she went above and beyond her job. She was, you know, in the ambulance with me, which they do. But then when we got to the hospital, she stayed with me. She put her work number into my phone and was like, you need to contact me like tomorrow, say that you're okay. I need to know that you're okay because I know that you can get through this. And having someone who genuinely believed in me, that didn't know me, it was really bizarre. And you know, everything I now get to do, I credit to Constable Campbell for that night, because she quite literally physically saved my life. But yeah, she's amazing. And now I get to do a lot of work with police. So I just spoke at a conference last week, actually, in New Zealand with a whole lot of officers. So it's kind of done a full 180.
Do you sort of see the hand of God in her saving you that night and in the way that she believed in you so much?
Oh, definitely. The story itself is pretty, like, I look back at all 14 suicide attempts and literal grace of God, I'm still here. Like, I shouldn't be at all. But the craziest things have happened. Like, you know, I would be literally going unconscious in the middle of a bush in the middle of nowhere and someone would just bike past and find me. But with Constable Campbell, I had everything planned. This was it. Like, I was good to go. And, when I went to jump, I was wearing a puffer jacket and my puffer jacket got caught on a branch. And so it made this like sound. And they were right below me and they heard that and then ran up. And so that I'm like that, you know, if they were on the other side of the park or anything like that, or if they weren't in that exact spot and my jacket didn't get caught, which is ridiculous. I still have that jacket and it's got a massive hole in it from the branch. I wouldn't be here. So definitely.
Mm. Yeah. God is good. You're a filmmaker and you make films about stories of hope. And your first was Dear Suicidal Me, with real people reading their own real suicide notes, including yourself. And then those same people speaking to their past selves with messages of hope. What kind of impact has that film had and what feedback have you got from people?
So that was the very first video that I did for Voices of Hope, and it now has over 80 million views. So it went international. We get hundreds of thousands of messages from people. I think one of my favourites is it was from a mother in Canada, and she emailed us and she was like, I've been trying to say, like, email you for a couple of weeks. I haven't known how to say it, but my 15-year-old daughter, she had decided that she was going to take her life. She had written her suicide note, got her method ready, and then she just jumped on social media to message her best friend goodbye. At the top of her newsfeed was your video, Dear Suicidal Me, and so she watched it. And as she watched it, she realised that she didn't want to take her life anymore, so she ran into my room, suicide note in hand, and sure enough, everything was set up in her room. So, you know, saying thank you so much, my daughter's still alive now because of that. And that's one of thousands of messages like that we've had from that video and kind of everything else that we've been able to create within films for Voices of Hope.
Wow. What is that particular story, for example, what does that make you feel when you first hear that?
I don't even know, like, because I do get those kind of messages almost every day now, and it's not something you ever get used to. You know, I was just in a school like a couple of hours ago and a girl came up to me afterwards and she was like, I wanted to take my life. I was done. I was it. But I just found hope for the first time today as you spoke. Thank you. And every time it's just, you know, I see myself and all these people and I'm like, it's amazing that something that could have once been so broken is now being used to literally see other lives saved. Yeah.
Wow. I've read a bit about your film Jessica's Tree as well, about your own friend who sadly took her life.
Yeah.
And in one of the topics in that film that you address is secrecy. What do you say to young people who, say, the young person who's got a friend who's suicidal but they've been asked to keep it a secret?
This is ridiculously common. And the biggest thing that I tell students and kids, and that kids, especially Jessica's friends from the show, have said to everyone else as well, they were like, I would rather have them angry and alive than not hear it all. And, you know, the danger of keeping those kinds of secrets is that, one, if they're telling you, then it is a scream for help. They may be like, don't tell anyone, but the tiniest part inside of them wants you to tell someone, because if they wouldn't have told you if they don't want some kind of intervention or help. But also, kind of keeping it to yourself means that if anything is to happen, that's what causes a ripple effect. That's what causes the kind of savior thing that we have, where we have to save people and I should have done this, I should have done that, this is all my fault. Whereas when you share it and you kind of, you know, talk to other people that are involved, other adults that are involved, that's when they can actually get real help. But people would rather have them messy and alive than not hear it all.
Mm. Now, since starting Voices of Hope, you've been traveling internationally to several countries speaking. You've met the Prime Minister of New Zealand and probably lots of other dignitaries. I know that you've met with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle to discuss mental health initiatives, and they came to you in New Zealand. And now there's a film being made about you called The Silence Film. Did you ever imagine that your story might have such an impact?
Never. If you were to tell the girl that was once sitting in the psych ward in the intensive care unit that one day this would be what I was doing, I would have laughed at you. And the crazy thing is, there was a guy, him and his wife have pretty much become my parents, Wayne and Libby. And Wayne was sitting with me in the intensive care unit after that final suicide attempt. And I was like, you know, I was all medication and like I was really out of it. And he just goes, Jazz, I think one day your story might change the world. And I was like, yeah, whatever, like I'm in a psych ward. I don't think so. I'm not even going to be alive next year. But he saw it before I could. And now to kind of, you know, sometimes I literally just have to sit back and look at everything that's happened, because everything's going so fast now, which is amazing. But to remember where I was is so humbling, because I now get to just represent hope in everything that I do, that if I can do it, if the girl from the psych ward can do it, then so can you.
Mm, awesome. There are many people who believe that once you have something like depression, then you have to manage it for the rest of your life and just survive. What's your view? Do you feel that you've overcome your mental illness?
100%. I think that I hate it when people say that. And it's something that, you know, psychologists and stuff have been talking about for ages. But I'm like, if someone gets cancer and overcomes it, they don't permanently have cancer for the rest of their life. They're more prone to it. And, you know, it might come up again. But that doesn't mean that for the rest of their life they have cancer. And so I think that that's the same within mental illness. And I'm proof now. I haven't had a single suicidal thought in years. And, you know, my psychologist literally was like, you don't have any traits of any of the illnesses that you used to have. Like, she was quite gobsmacked by it. But, yeah, I don't think that you have to only manage. I think that you can learn how to fight. And it's different for everyone, but it is possible to live without it, and I'm proof of that.
Do you still have to have things like counselling or medication at times? Or
no.
You sort of, that's part of your past now and you...
Yeah, I don't do it at all anymore.
Yep.
Yeah.
And would you say that, like, with the hectic schedule and everything that you have, do you have to do a lot of self-care to make sure that you don't burn out?
Yeah, I've got really good people around me that will, you know, ensure that I'm taking time when I need to. And it's been good because I've been able to learn off people who live a similar lifestyle as well, who are constantly on the road, and kind of learning how they do it. And, you know, I'm a massive introvert. And so even if it's like just in the car in between schools or on the plane or whatever it is, just kind of taking time and introverting, but yeah, I've got solid people, and I can see if I'm getting too overwhelmed or it's too much. But I remember a friend saying to me quite recently, actually, when I was getting stressed out, and she was like, Jazz, you're literally living in the prayers that you once prayed as a kid. And I was like, oh, true. So I know that I'm graced to do this. And so it's, you know, self-care is important, really important. I wouldn't be able to do what I do without it.
Mm. Just two final questions. Firstly, what would you say to those who are suffering from suicidal thoughts or mental illness to give them hope? And what advice would you give to family and friends?
To people who are struggling, I think that the first thing that I would say is that hope is not just a word that we say, that hope is never lost, but sometimes our situations can stop us from seeing it. And so what I discovered was that it's not about battling your past, but fighting for your future. We spend so long battling the things that have happened to us or battling the things that we've done, but that really doesn't get us anywhere except in circles. And it's only when we choose to look at the future, even if it's one day ahead, even if it's one week ahead, and decide to fight for that, knowing that you are so worth it, that you're not what your mind is telling you, that you're not a burden, and you're not unlovable, you don't deserve to be punished, whatever it is that your mind is telling you is not true. And then to friends and family, Jess's dad actually says this in the series. He says, you might hate the behavior, but you love the child, and that will never change. And I think that's really important to remember, that, you know, this is an illness that, you know, if people are, your kids or your friends are acting up or they're hurting themselves or whatever it may be, that it's your job to be consistent and to not give up on them. You're not their psychologist, you're not their doctor. That's not your job. Your job is to be consistent. Your job is to speak hope. Your job is to speak into the future, because it's impossible to fight if they don't know what they're fighting for. And when they can't see it, that's when it's your job to speak it to them. But yeah, don't give up on them, because you never know kind of what the next day will bring.
Mm, awesome. Thank you, Jazz. Thanks for your time. Jazz Thornton, and you can find out more about her at voicesofhope.org.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.